Tech Pro Tito, thank you for joining me. It's good to have you
Bah.
on. It's good to have you on again. So, yeah, I just returned from your neck of the woods, or close to it, so to speak, Ukraine. Yeah, we wanted to speak earlier this week. I got back and I got like so badly sick and I could barely talk, and I was hacking and coughing and feeling a little bit better today. Yeah, usually when I fly, I get pretty screwed up as far as my sinuses, and I'll catch a cold. Two of the people I flew with actually caught, two of the people I crossed back over from Ukraine caught COVID. Thankfully, I missed it, but yeah. So, we had some discussions offline, and I really wanted to kind of get you on here because I thought you had some pretty good insights, but you also had some pretty good questions of me. And what I saw and what I experienced, and some of the insights that you're so well known for on here. What's the where would you like to go? Where would you like to start with that?
Well, first off, I would have been incredibly insulted and probably not return if you head over to Eastern Europe not to talk to Tech Pro Tito. Now, obviously, Eastern Europe is slightly different than Balkans or Yugoslavia or former Yugoslavia, as it were. But if we're dealing with Slavic people, if we're dealing with Slavic people, not talking to Tech Pro Tito is major faux pas. First off, let us cover this. Yes, I wish to cover several things. First off, for American listeners who do not understand this, Aaron is very well traveled, very tough, very knowledgeable person, but somehow never understood, or somehow, despite being all well traveled and all such, did not understand the importance of bringing American $100 bills with her to a war zone. Very stupid. It took me to actually put $100 bills, as I am well known to do for bribery, into her hand and say, "You take this, these will be useful, and you better give good story if you spend my $100. Or more than $100, but $100 bills." And what happens when you reach there?
I ended up I had some Polish money, and I went ahead because I had your money, and I didn't withdraw any Polish money. I got there, and nothing, it was interesting because my cards worked in Poland without an issue, which I was a little surprised to see. The times I've traveled last time, I've usually had to call and yell at the people to make sure my cards work. But, it worked fine in Poland, and I got to Ukraine, and like absolutely nothing worked. Thankfully, Ukraine is it's fairly cheap as far as expenses go. So, it wasn't like San Francisco prices or anything. But yeah, so I thankfully they have a pretty good exchange rate there, so it worked out in my favor.
But why did you end up? But why are the $100 bills so relevant, as I'm asking you?
Oh yeah, because I used them to pay for stuff, so it
But
worked out pretty well.
why did you not withdraw your own money and spend my money?
Because you gave me your money, so I was like, well,
Because
I've got Tech
in a
Bros
war
money.
zone, ATMs don't necessarily work.
Yeah, ATMs are it was interesting because ATMs don't really work there. I mean, there's ATMs, and it's kind of hit or miss. Like, I did see some pretty sizable lines at the ATM. Not like the crazy ones we're seeing from Russia, for example, with videos. But, you would see pretty decent lines at some of the ATMs. It was really interesting because, I've been talking about, and this kind of parlays over into what I was, have kind of touched on. And I thought you had some pretty good insights on it. Excuse me. About as far as, I kept talking about a hurricane was a lot like what happened there. But I thought you had some pretty good insights on that. Go ahead.
We don't have hurricanes in my part of the world, and so
Yeah.
you have this very parochial desire. Oh, I will only speak to people in hurricane zone of Southeast America, of South America, and of Pacific Coast areas. And how parochial of you? Perhaps, perhaps people in Rockaways understand, but how many people that live in Boston understand what a hurricane is, and specifically what you meant by it? Very parochial, very stupid, and without translating for other people, you intentionally limit your audience. But worse than that, you give them the Dunning-Kruger effect, where they think they understand what you mean by the hurricane, but you're leaving so much meat on the bone. It is capitalist pig dog attempt to just throw away essentially a full chicken, saying everything's been gnawed off of it, when it's essentially full chicken, one bite taken out of.
Good point. One of the things it's I think that, it's re there's really two reasons I was originally saying a hurricane. It's because, it's a very wide-ranging disaster that covers a wide area, but it's also a type of disaster that gives people warning. Like, you see it coming, so people start leaving early and some people stay. So it's like anyone, especially from, again, it's the people that on the coast, the people on the coast understand this. People who are not on the coast don't. There's the question of, do you bug in or do you bug out? Do I like fill my house up with food and water and ride out the hurricane, or do I get on the road and risk, breaking down or getting stuck in traffic or getting somewhere and there's no hotel rooms? So it's a really interesting type of phenomena and like a disaster type situation. And I was originally thinking of that because, again, you have your warning, and I'm like, a lot of the other natural disasters, you really don't have that type of warning. An earthquake kind of happens. You don't get a chance. Like, there's gonna be an earthquake 3 or 4 days from now. You kind of don't really have a warning like that. And that really was, that's what I was thinking about, really, kind of with wars, because, everyone you people was paying attention kind of saw it coming. And even now, the invasion, like a military, a fast invasion, they say, moves about 1 or 2 miles an hour. A military invasion, an average of 1 to 2 miles an hour. So, yeah, you've got this situation where there's tremendous damage in certain areas, and as long as you're not right on the border, you can kind of see it coming. But yeah, like, you are right, that was a little bit of a parochial thing. If you have not seen a hurricane, if you have not experienced one, that wasn't something that was immediately accessible. So yeah, what else were you thinking about
Specifically,
that?
again, you're leaving the points on the table that are most salient, because
Yeah.
you have trouble getting out of your head. Let me help.
Go ahead.
People don't die from hurricanes. Galveston, Texas, I guess, killed many people 100 or so years ago. That is not how people die, nor is that the negative effects from hurricanes today. The biggest effect of hurricane, the acute effect of hurricane, maybe affects 10% of people in hurricane, getting hit by winds, getting hit by rising water. It's more the logistic problem, this being evacuation, this being, is there enough water on evacuation routes? Is there enough food? Is there enough housing? Is there enough medicine? Is there air conditioning for elderly people trying to evacuate who may die from heat exhaustion much quicker than other people on evacuation route? It's a logistical issue. And so people say, oh, well, it's a war. If you don't go to war and you don't go to direct effects of where they're actually shelling things, you're not at war. But your point is that a hurricane is not just the area hit by hurricane. It extends 100 miles or so in radius from the front of the hurricane, because the effects, people cleaning out supermarkets to stock up on milk and eggs and bread and bottled water, all these repercussions, the taking all the money out of ATMs, all these effects radiate outwards. And so it's a much bigger net effect. The acute effects of hurricane maybe affect, again, probably maximum 10% of people that either choose to bug in, get stuck there, whatever. But the other much bigger effects, the number of people affected and the sort of total number of man hours or man hours of misery, as you call it, or whatever, the much bigger effects are not actually at the hurricane, but radiating out from it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a ripple effect that excuse me, there's a ripple effect that comes out from a natural disaster. Excuse me. I'm still not quite over this, but I'm feeling a little bit better. Yeah, there's definitely a ripple effect that comes out from this. And, you know, it's, you would think, like, hey, if you're not just getting shelled, you're okay. But, you know, there's a mob of people on the highway. You can see this, you know, natural disaster coming, or war or natural disaster smashing things. The infrastructure for a modern society is not really built for this. It's not really built to handle these massive shifts of, like, people and food and money and everything else. Fuel, for example. It's this tremendous ripple effect, because now so much of the population has moved in a short amount of time. Something like, there are now up to like 4 million people have left Ukraine, which is 10% of the population. I think they say the estimate is around 10 million Ukrainians have been displaced, which means 10% of the population, I'm sorry, 25% of the population has had to pick up and move. They may still be in the country, but they have been internally displaced to the West. And like, again, like I saw this in Lviv, they said it's normally 700,000 people. They had 200,000 people there, which 200,000 extra, which is, you know, the buildings were swamped. Like, they were turning everything they could into some sort of refugee shelter. You know, there was a lot of, there was still food there because so much food is being shipped in. But, you know, like you said, the ATMs were usually swamped. The banks were usually swamped. I didn't really have a trouble. I noticed it was very interesting because the exchange rate for the U.S. dollar was extremely narrow. And it's really kind of interesting because, you know, if you've ever traveled internationally, you usually see, like, if you go to it's better to get foreign currency in your own currency before in your own country before you go. But then when you get there, and it was a really good rate, between, you know, buying and selling the dollar in Ukraine, which, you know, kind of tells me, like, they were really trying to get as much dollars as possible. And another interesting thing I noticed was the euro had a wider spread. It was, you know, again, the exchange rate was a little, you got a little bit more of the Ukrainian currency for the euro, because the euro currently is worth more than the dollar, but the spread was wider. And it's really kind of telling you that, like, they want U.S. dollars. You know, that is what they're trying to buy. They have a very narrow range there. That's the one that they prefer.
Underappreciated idea. So, many of your viewers may be familiar with the idea of petrodollar, U.S. dollar as a reserve currency of world, of oil transactions, all transacting U.S. dollars. And what's happened, of course, is cutting off SWIFT to Russia, not to go too deep into it. Point is, Russia is now attempting to receive payment for oil in rubles as opposed to U.S. dollars. And U.S. Every oil transaction worldwide has had to be transacted in U.S. dollars. There are many conspiracy theories pointing out that there were attempts by people like Gaddafi to move off of accepting U.S. dollars to gold or the gold-backed dinar, supposedly Saddam Hussein, and they point to the regime change and absolute ferocity of American military attack on any country that attempts to move off of U.S. dollar denominating in oil. Because essentially, idea economically, not to go too deep into weeds, there's excellent points by people like, I'm a huge fan of a man named Michael Hudson as an alternative economist. Really fantastic reading. But the point is essentially, by the American dollar being the only way you can buy oil worldwide, in between, say, Saudi Arabia and Nigeria or whatever, the entire point is, has to buy U.S. dollars, or there's strong demand for U.S. dollars worldwide, and this makes U.S. dollars essentially what gold used to be, basically accepted everywhere, the currency to be used in the war zone. This is why I made sure you took U.S. dollars to war zone, specifically with the instruction, this should be spent. If they point AK at you, you say American, American, you hold out dollars, and this will give you a much higher chance of survival. Things you learn from Yugoslavia.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, the whole thing with that is, like, the oil contracts and so much of the international debt and other international financial instruments, the settlement currency, like, when you when you pay off an oil contract or a wheat contract or something like that, or a bond or whatever, it will specify the currency it has to be paid off in. And a lot of this currency, especially like the petrodollar, like what you're saying, or almost all oil contracts are supposed to be settled in dollars. That means you have to actually, even if they're not physical dollars, they're like electronic dollars. That means that there's a demand for the currency because, you know, the person is like, I want you, when you pay this, when you pay me for these barrels of oil, you will deliver X amount of money in American currency. So that demand, it's basically a supply and demand. Just the fact that, you know, these oil contracts have to be settled in U.S. dollars creates a demand for U.S. dollars and makes U.S. dollars more valuable.
And not just the demand. Important, not just demand, creates stable demand. So the idea of elasticity, not to go too deep into economics, but the idea is, you know, if your paycheck goes down, you can switch from eating steak to eating hamburger, for example. Or as a recent Bloomberg article said, you know, if you're, you know, you're, everyone's going to be hurt except people earning $300,000 a year. So you should eat lentils, not eat meat. Eat the bugs. Excuse me, they didn't say that, but they essentially implied it. Don't get medical care for your animals. Let them die in agony. It was encouraging these things. But you can make choices to eat hamburger instead of steak. You simply cannot run economy without oil. So there's inelastic demand. No matter what happens, you can't not go to work and earn a paycheck. So the oil will always be there, will always be demanded. And so it creates very robust demand that you simply can't get past.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. And that's what's concerning is, you know, there's been movements away from this. Like, I think Iran is like wanting to move away from that now. There's some talk about I think China is talking about doing the yuan for some things. There, you know, and like one of the things is the other day Russia is now like, you know, if you they're talking about people that are not favored nations will have to actually pay for their oil and gas in the ruble, which is again a tactic to prop up the ruble, because if people actually start paying for oil and gas from Russia with rubles, there's a demand for rubles, and that's going to increase the strength of the currency.
And beyond that, important, the currency wars essentially become proxy wars. And so that means then that essentially if Germany, being such a large customer, this is the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia, Nord Stream 2, which is sort of put on hold. But Germany can't keep people warm and will lead to tens of thousands of deaths in winter if Russia does not supply gas to Germany. Let's speak very clearly as what this means. No one says this in clear speak. I wish to speak clearly so Americans may understand the European politics. We do at least tens of thousands of deaths and much financial hardship. No way around this. And so what this then means then is if Germany has to buy gas in the rubles, what this means then is that German finance and people that have treasuries in Germany essentially are invested in the future of Germany. Suddenly this means all these people involved in all these contracts now have a vested interest in Germany not getting soaked by losing money as they hold the ruble to buy gas with. And so this then draws all these sophisticated financial investors onto the side of Russia.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that's going to force people to, you know, I mean, and it's, Germany has put themselves in kind of a bind. They don't have, they've gotten rid of their nuclear reactors, and I think they're decommissioning them later, their last six or so, like this year. They're extremely dependent on, you know, the natural gas from Russia to warm their houses and buildings, and you know, especially in the winter, which is again, it's March, it's almost April, so maybe there's a little bit less time, but then again, that sort of infrastructure build out for alternatives is not something they have the time to do.
Or it will impoverish old people trying to keep themselves from dying in winter. People in Northeast are probably very familiar with this dynamic.
Yeah. That's something that they have to worry about as well. You know, just for either impoverish people or freeze them to death, and it's going to put Germany in kind of a bind there, especially in this. What's that? Go ahead.
Well, again, not just Germany is the issue. People talk about Germany. It's people that buy a Germany treasury bills that essentially invest in the future of Germany. Suddenly, because financial markets are complicated and such, you essentially then have vested interests that instead of everyone being united against Russia and united against cutting them off of SWIFT and all that, suddenly you have people that have sort of longer-term financial interests in Germany based off of, again, treasury bills and other sort of arcane financial instruments. All of a sudden, they will lose, and suddenly they're basically at odds with the people that are trying to sanction Russia, and it forces them to actually take Russia's side, or they lose out in the same deal.
Yeah. Another thing that's kind of related to that, when we're talking about the ripple effects, and it's also kind of related to something to keep in mind here. Again, everyone knows we have a midterms elections coming up later this year. People have been focused so much, and I've mentioned this before. One aspect of the Ukrainian deal is, I was, looking at the map, the centennial year. This is a centennial year for the east and the southeast of Ukraine being added to Ukraine from Russia. It seems like they've made a serious, like, that's where their biggest advances have been around Crimea and along the coast. And not only is that the centennial year of that part of Ukraine being added on to the state of Ukraine when they created the Soviet Union, but it's also like the part of Ukraine that is where most of the planting takes place. I mean, it's I think what Ukraine is like the second or third largest wheat producer in the world. Russia's number one. So yeah. if Russia can take control of the wheat, and you've got like something like 30% of the wheat that's offline of the wheat production. Another thing to keep in mind is like the winter wheat has already been planted. It should be harvested sometime in May, they were saying. So if they can't stop, I mean, the biggest combat is happening around there. So if they can't get this thing within the next couple of weeks, get it sort of settled and start harvesting this wheat, which God knows, even if they can get it ended very quickly, the infrastructure just is so destroyed down there that we're going to be looking at a massive wheat shortage this year. Either way, what happens, it's going to be a significant wheat shortage. And, one of the things people, forget about a lot of times is, a spike in the price of wheat is what a big major driver for the Arab Spring in 2011. So that's like another one of the issues of people have not, we've been so focused on Ukraine, the combat there, number one, but we've also been focused on the domestic implications of that, like in terms of projecting each side onto the domestic enemy and using it like as a cudgel to beat the other person. But people have not really stopped to think very much other than like some very sharp, forward-thinking people. There hasn't really been this massive, like, holy shit, wait a minute, 30% of the wheat production is basically gone now. We have these massive, especially like in the Middle East now, like North Africa, you have these people who can barely feed themselves in the best times, and they're about to lose a massive amount of the food supply. Even if they can get it, it's going to be so expensive, it's going to impoverish them. So we're looking North Africa, Middle East,
Africa.
Well, Sub-Saharan Africa too. Basically, right. everyone.
Food importation, Sub-Saharan Africa. You're like looking forward to seeing the entire continent of Africa explode. My understanding is they are huge importers particularly from Russia and Ukraine. And so they will particularly, generally being among the poorest bloc nations, but again, you see Arab Spring also has that sort of knock-on effects. It's almost guaranteed to be issue there, if not, and not just Middle East, but almost guaranteed to be there at that systemic level.
Yeah, we're going to have an issue. I mean, it's like wheat. It's kind of like, I mean, they say oil is fungible. It's not exactly fungible in the sense they mean it, but it is like the prices for different grades of crude do interact. Wheat's, you know, much more fungible. And even if like you can get wheat, if your wheat is still coming, the fact that you're going that the global market of wheat has lost so much, you know, output is going to have a massive effect. So, you know, we're looking at, like, even when the war's over, the knock-on effects of this. When we talk, again, we talk about, it's interesting because when you look at Ukraine and you look at, we started talking about the ripple effects within Ukraine itself, but then you start zooming out and you see these big, massive, these meta ripples that have serious, maybe even more destructive damage. Like, you know, Europe, you know, there's a good chance that by the end of 2022, Europe will be unable to, you know, keep itself warm, to keep itself from freezing, because they either don't have any natural gas or they don't have enough, or what they have is so expensive people can't afford it. And then you're looking at like Africa and the Middle East cannot feed themselves, because especially in Africa, because wheat, I was saying North Africa, because like the wheat is, you know, so dramatic part, like especially like Egypt. The wheat is such a big part of their staple. Again, like Sub-Saharan Africa is the same way. But you're going to have, you know, big chunks of the world that probably can't afford to feed themselves. And that's really going to be very concerning, because, you know, you've got the European continent that's going to be in turmoil, probably from energy prices. And then Africa, and especially North Africa, which has proximity to Europe, which all of a sudden can't feed itself. So, you know, are we going to see massive immigration outflows from refugee flows from places that are starving to a place that cannot afford to feed itself, whose economy's been wrecked because they can't afford energy prices? So that's going to be a twofer right there. And that's really, really concerning. And people, you know, everyone's so focused on Slava Ukrainian. Believe me, like, I just came back from there. The Ukrainian spirit is infectious. Like, they have such high morale. And it's hard not to cheer for them. And I do cheer for them. Like, you know, they are being invaded. I think that's pretty indisputable. There's geopolitical considerations involved and critiques that I'm not really going to get into, because that'll be a good thing to discuss on a separate episode. But yeah, you know, you look at that stuff, then you zoom out, like, holy shit, you know, is Europe going to be able to keep itself warm? Then you zoom out more and you're like, holy shit, half the world's not going to be able to feed itself. What's going to happen when both of those things let go at the same time?
Right. Well, and the concerning thing, there's many people talk about conspiracy theories. Many people that talk about things to look at Great Reset, World Economic Forum, yada yada yada. Biden saying the new liberal world order. We're getting new world order, echoing words of George H.W. Bush about the new world order. The issue itself is, regardless of what catchphrases you wish to use, it's difficult to look at the situation going on. Do not read Mackinder, who wrote a book in 1904 about the world island hypothesis, and this basically being about essentially risk, but in the real world, and that to control, you must control Eastern Europe to control Eurasia. Whoever controls Eurasia, essentially controls the trade routes, essentially controls the world. And then this is further refined in the idea of shatter belts by, I believe, Pilsudski, who is a Polish man, who fifth person, but Pilsudski refined with shatter belts. And then, you know, a further refinement essentially saying, if you cannot control Eastern Europe or control essentially Eurasian landmass, what you could do is you can essentially cause devastation and cause cause instability in the region. And if you can't control it, you can cause instability, which means no one else can control it either, and you essentially take it off the board. So it's very difficult, essentially, to look at moves happening in this region of the world, and then to see the gas prices that may screw Europe, and then essentially starving half the world, and not scratch your head and really wonder. People really are playing big game of risk. One of the problems I have with conservatives, you don't suffer so much from this, which is why I talk to you, but one of the problems I have talking with conservatives day to day is they continually believe this ridiculous form of logic, which has never been proved, and it's called the Hanlon's Razor. It essentially, it's a precept that states, never attribute to malice what can be attributed to stupidity. Why? Why say you this? You know, do I not, you know, why do I must assume stupidity instead of malice? This clearly comes, honestly, from a man who's never dealt with malicious people. Malicious people can be stupid, malicious people can be smart, but malicious people are malicious and will do malicious things just because they can. You know, to state the oft-remarked story Trump told of Scorpion, you know, on the frog's back stings frog as it's swimming across and they're both going to drown. Frog asks why Scorpion stung. Scorpion says, because it's in my nature. You're too stupid to take me across. And so, of course, I'm going to sting you and kill us both. It's who I am. Maliciousness knows no bounds. And yet, conservatives in general simply can't conceive of evil. Despite supposedly being Christians, which is based off of a worldview of there being evil in world that controls mortal world, apparently evil doesn't exist. And I'm sorry for my outrage, but I simply think you are a bad Christian who doesn't believe what you say you believe if you don't believe evil does things and has massive power in the world and will do things just to cause devastation and to cause power.
I think that's a good point. I mean, you know, it's easy to kind of fall back on Hanlon's razor because there is so much stupidity in the world. But, you know, there's a point where, you know, or to kind of flip it on its side there, there's a certain point of stupidity that's indistinguishable from malice. You know, malice and stupidity can be effectively interchangeable at a point where if it's so stupid and so predictably stupid, that's effectively becomes malice.
Does it matter if Mao Zedong really thought that plants would grow twice the density if you planted crops with half distance in between? Did it really matter if Mao Zedong really thought that stoning birds to death would stop them from raiding crops and instead led to massive insects destroying crops leading to the Great Famine, a Great Leap Forward famine that is estimated to have killed 60 million plus? Does it really matter why, or does it matter that it happened? The two are indistinguishable, and yet everyone wants to say, oh, he's stupid and all that. And yet he's still held on to power, still held on to control. And at a certain point, you just have to say, quit it, quit your happy worldview, and actually face things. I, you know, as Ted Pro Tito, you know, Tito underappreciated the aspect of what Josip Broz Tito did, is Josip Broz Tito managed to fight off both Hitler as well as Stalin and preserve neutrality of Yugoslavia, to preserve it while maintaining sphere of influence next to Stalin, of all things. Tito did not do this through being naive and saying, oh, Stalin is just stupid.
I think one of the things that, you know, is not fully appreciated when we look at malice versus stupidity is, you know, so many like Mao and some of the other cases you've cited about things that were just abjectly stupid. These people were able to make stupid decisions and avoid the consequences of their actions because they were protected or they had seized power. So because they had no consequences, they felt encouraged and comfortable to do things that were just patently stupid because there was no pushback, there was no blowback from it. So I do think like when a system protects people that are stupid, even if the conscious decision of the people in the system is not to do malice, it's effectively malice because you're like, this person's stupid or this person has seized power and they don't belong here. But, you know, if they feel relaxed and entitled to do things that are very destructive, that, you know, or even if it's just they mean well, but they're not concerned about, you know, the potential side effects or if it's going to discredit them, then it becomes malice, definitionally. Just because if you cover up for stupidity or insulate yourself from the, you know, to the natural blowback for the decisions you make, even if you mean well, but you make a dumb decision, and it's technically stupidity in isolation, it becomes malice because of the context of it.
Right. I simply don't care for mental midgets who must preserve just world hypothesis of world, who won't understand that it's consequentialism, it's actual effects that matter, and not that, you know, if I call to talk to you of man that cancels Christmas, destroys it, and outlaws it, and arrests people, and punishes them for celebrating Christmas, you may think I'm talking of the worst democratic view, the communist socialists. I'm talking about Oliver Cromwell, who is a devout Christian in England. He was not doing it from malice. He believed that Christmas itself was a pagan tradition trying to subvert and overwhelm Christianity. It doesn't matter whether or not Cromwell was malicious, which he did not seem himself to be, and saw himself as appointed by God on earth to advance Christendom. It matters that he canceled Christmas. If you take Christmas as a red line, if someone tries to cancel Christmas, I will go red on. It does not matter. And furthermore, when you attribute stupidity to someone like that, it means you don't plan to actually combat in an effective way. It says, oh, well, he's stupid. I can just wait for him to make mistake. But, you know, his entire life, virtually his entire life, Cromwell just led blessed life. And he truly believed he was being guided by God because of all the improbable victories he had. So this is the thing, you treat him stupidly, but he's not. If you treat someone stupid, if you treat someone as a genius who's stupid, you have to go to extra work, but it doesn't generally cost you that much. You treat someone who's genius, but you treat them as stupid, you will end up defeated every time.